You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's a love letter to Wisconsin and its people, and it's funny. We'll talk with a duo behind a new album about how it came together, their friendship, and what makes our state such a special place. Now, Wisconsin's partial election recount continues in Milwaukee and Dane counties. It got underway last Friday, and election officials said the process started off slowly after a steady stream of objections from observers with the Trump campaign. In Milwaukee County, County Clerk George Christensen reminded observers to raise their concerns through the proper channels. Here's a listen.
Please refrain from asking questions to the station tabulators, as you were instructed previously. If you continue to do so, you will be asked to leave.
Since then, Christensen says the process has started to move more smoothly. That was echoed by Dane County Clerk Scott McDonald earlier this week.
The objections are clearly into predictable categories around the witness signature, witness address, voter signature, initials of the clerk. So we're able to kind of get through those objections quicker.
Yesterday afternoon, a conservative group filed a lawsuit against the Wisconsin Elections Commission, asking the state Supreme Court to dismiss the election results entirely and let the state legislature pick electors on its own. And today, President Trump told a group of Pennsylvania lawmakers that voting was rigged and, quote, this election has to be turned around. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the recount here, the partial recount here in Wisconsin, the Trump campaign filing for that? What do you think about the lawsuit filed yesterday that would toss out Wisconsin's election results altogether? Call in at 800-642-1234 or join in with your questions about election law and how it all works. 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. Robert Yablon is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School and an expert on election law. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here. Looking forward to an all Rob chat.
Nothing but Robs. Well, non-Robs can call in, though. We'll allow that this time. Now, what is your take, Rob, on how this partial recount is playing out so far?
You know, it's moving along, and it looks like both counties, Milwaukee County and Dane County, aren't going to have any trouble meeting the state's deadline for certifying the results, which is Tuesday. I mean, the county clerks that we just heard from indicated that there have been some hiccups along the way. The process is also made more challenging by the, you know, the need to maintain social distancing and other pandemic related safety measures. So far it's been relatively smooth. We haven't seen any significant change in the vote tallies at all. There's no indication that we will.
The objections being made here don't seem to be falling the lines of individual cases of fraud or lots of individual ballots that are suspicious in any way. There have been some changes, not huge, but broad categories based on how election law in Wisconsin was implemented. Can you talk about the objections raised by the Trump campaign, rejected by county election officials, and probably going to make an appearance in our courts pretty soon?
Right. So, you know, I think you're referring to kind of the big picture objections that were made in the recount petition and have been made on the ground in these counties to whole categories of votes and whether they should be counted. And so that is involving issues like whether the counties should throw out all of the absentee ballots in which a clerk filled in some of the address details on the envelope. And, the Trump campaign here is arguing that that violates state law, although it's been the practice in Wisconsin for quite a while and has not been challenged. So, you know, that is one of the categorical objections that's being made. There is an objection to whether those who voted early properly made an absentee ballot request, as Wisconsin law requires. Again, this isn't a novel new practice for this election. It's also not something specific to Dane or Milwaukee counties. It's happened all over the state, but that's the objection. And then there are some concerns being raised about people who might have classified themselves as indefinitely confined. And if you're an absentee voter who is so designated, you don't have to comply with the normal voter ID requirements. And so there are some issues raised with respect to that as well.
Yeah, President Trump had tweeted about Wisconsin in particular, quoting, "In Wisconsin, somebody has to be indefinitely confined in order to vote absentee. In the past, there were 20,000 people. This past election, there were 120,000, and Republicans were locked out of the vote counting process. Now, none of that is true. In Wisconsin, first of all, you don't have to be indefinitely confined in order to vote absentee, right?
That's right. I mean, we have what's called no excuse absentee balloting in Wisconsin. If you're an eligible voter in the state, you are eligible to vote absentee. The only difference that the indefinitely confined designation makes is it does allow you to become exempt from the standard voter ID requirement.
And the numbers he gave were wrong, but there was an increase in absentee voting. There was also an increase in people making that indefinitely confined claim to not have to do some of that witness requirement. But the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel did an analysis. The proportion of people making that claim of indefinite confined went down as a proportion of absentee ballots. So what do you make of the change there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I've seen the same numbers. I guess it's no surprise that when you have almost 10 times as many people voting absentee this election, that you would also see an uptick in the number of people who make that indefinitely confined classification, partly because, you know, it got the numbers of voters who are voting absentee, but it got more attention this time around. And so, you know, it's hard to know, it's hard to see anything nefarious associated with that. And although the objection has been raised to the idea that there's been this increase in indefinitely confined voters, I'm not aware of any specific instances in which they're arguing that a particular voter used this in a fraudulent manner.
Talking to Robert Yablon, associate professor in the UW Law School, about Wisconsin's recount and other legal issues related to the election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Brian is with us in Port Washington. Brian, hello.
Yes, so I just have a question in reference to the witness for the absentee ballots. What's the actual legality of the individuals that are doing the absentee ballots and adding the addresses for ones that were missing?
Brian, thanks for the call. We briefly started to touch on that, Rob, but can you talk about that a little more? This is one of the things being contested where somebody in the county clerk's office, say, or in the voting, who somebody's reviewing votes, can, with information, fill in the witness address, if possible. What do we know about that?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, all that we have in the state statutes is that it says that if the absentee ballot is incomplete, right, that there's something missing from from the envelope, then it shouldn't be counted. But it doesn't say anything about, you know, how you correct an error that might be made. And so, you know, something that might often happen is the witness will write down their street address, but maybe they won't write down the city and the zip code. And so the practice in the state has been, since at least 2016, and I think for at least 11 elections now, that the Elections Commission has given guidance that as long as the election officials are able to figure out the information that should have been put there, right, they can look at the street address and know what the zip code was, they can fill that in. And so under the legal guidance that's been provided by the Elections Commission, that is valid. The argument that's being made here is, despite that consistent practice for a while, it nevertheless isn't consistent with the actual text of the statute.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Eli now in La Crosse. Eli, hello.
Hi, I just wanted to say that all the challenges being made to the elections, like, it's pretty obvious at this point that Biden won, and our current president is more of a media campaign disguised as a legal campaign at this point. And yes, the DOJ should investigate to prove that there wasn't any voter fraud, at least no negligible voter fraud. But at this point, all the recounts, all the lawsuits, it needs to stop, and everything needs to start, transfer of power and everything.
Eli, thanks a lot for the call. Eli makes that distinction between the media campaign and the legal effort here, Rob, and in media efforts, including the president's call to a group of Republican Pennsylvania lawmakers, large-scale claims of fraud, that hasn't been really what we think of as fraud, hasn't really been part of a lot of the legal challenges in courtrooms, though, has it?
No, that's right. I mean, there's been a mismatch basically between some of the rhetoric that you get from the president and his allies and then what his lawyers are actually arguing in court. You know, and to make an argument in court, you need to have a good faith basis. You need to have some evidence. And they just really haven't come up with anything other than these really small scale technical issues that they're raising, not just in Wisconsin, but in other states as well. And nearly all of those lawsuits now have fizzled. The president and his lawyers have had very little success whatsoever in court.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Rob Yablon, associate professor at the UW Law School, looking at Wisconsin's recount, how it's playing out, and legal challenges to election results here and elsewhere. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of concerns about Wisconsin's election being raised by the Trump campaign during this recount? How about a lawsuit from a conservative group saying, hey, state Supreme Court, throw out the election results, let the state legislature decide who Wisconsin's electors will be? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Rob Yablon, associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, expert on election law, looking at the state's partial recount and other legal challenges going on when it comes to the election. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Rob, I want to look at this lawsuit from a conservative group calling itself the Wisconsin Voters Alliance, asking the state Supreme Court to declare the election results in effect null and void and hand it over to the legislature, the power to choose Wisconsin's electors. What's your take on that?
Well, this is a pretty radical lawsuit. Legally, it seems quite flimsy. They are making most of the same arguments that were made in the recount petition. So the ones that are currently getting worked out in that process. And so, I think there are timing problems with the lawsuit. There are substantive problems with the lawsuit. There are remedial problems with it. And so I don't expect that it's going to do any better than any of the other litigation that the president had. I mean, just to point out one of the procedural problems, as I mentioned before, most of the technicalities that are being objected to now are rules that have been in practice for multiple elections now and that were known about prior to the election. And so to the extent that someone had concerns about those rules, the proper time to raise those concerns would have been before the voting started. Because once people are voting in reliance on those processes, and once electoral officials are relying on those processes, then a court is going to be very reluctant to allow someone to come in after the fact and throw out those votes. And that's ultimately what they're seeking. They want to nullify the votes of the 3 million plus Wisconsinites who have voted. And that really is an unprecedented remedy to be seeking.
Go back to our callers now. Laura is with us in Cudahy. Laura, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because, first of all, as your expert was saying, we have had years now where the rules that they're seeking to throw out have been followed. And I am from Milwaukee County. I early voted. And I'm very angry that anybody is trying to disenfranchise me and my vote. I think that the Trump campaign is grasping at straws. I was not happy with the result 4 years ago, but I accepted that Trump was president, and the people have spoken, and to put forth all of these roadblocks is just, to me, very upsetting, and I think it sets a very bad precedent.
Laura, thanks a lot for the call. Rob, talk about the precedent that Laura is worried about here.
Well, I think a lot of people are concerned that this is, the president's refusal to concede his continuation with these legal challenges and allegations of fraud that have been unsupported in any of the court filings, that does do some, long-term damage to our democratic system, to the norms that we rely on. You know, we thankfully have a very long tradition in this country of peaceful transitions of power, of the acceptance of the legitimacy of the winner of an election. And, to the extent that the president is stoking divisions and suggesting that the new president is not the rightfully elected leader, I mean, that just isn't healthy for our democratic system.
Thanks for that call, Laura. One outcome, one possible outcome here from the recounts and possible subsequent legal challenges would be people who vote in those categories we talked about earlier in Milwaukee and Dane County could have their votes tossed out. The other 70 counties in the state who operated under the same system would be unaffected. Is that something courts look at and worry about if they change the rules, but just for some counties in a state?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. I mean, I think that is going to be a major problem for the president's lawyers if they do file a lawsuit of their own after the recount concludes. You know, one of the big issues in Bush versus Gore was that there were inconsistencies county by county in the way that votes were counted or not counted. And that seems to be exactly what the president would be seeking here, because if you were in Milwaukee or Dane County and you voted using one of these methods, or you had a clerk that filled in a little bit of information on the absentee ballot envelope, that vote would be thrown out. But if you voted somewhere else in the state the exact same way, the vote would be counted. And so I think absolutely that would be a consideration for courts.
Let's go back to our callers now. Kathleen is with us in Glendale. Kathleen, hi.
Hi, how are you? My concern is the envelope for the absentee ballot. I've used that numerous times, and I always have to take it to a neighbor or to a relative to be the witness. And so nowhere does it say that it has to be the same color ink. So when I read that they were looking at the colors of ink on these absentee ballots, that bothered me. And I hope that that's not really what's happening.
Kathleen, thanks for the call. And to clarify, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Rob, it isn't the voters' information and the witnesses' information have to be in the same color ink. The Trump campaign challengers here are saying that if the, the witnesses' information, if like their name and signature are one color and their address is another color, that suggests it was completed by a clerk or election official. That's what they're trying to throw out, right?
Yeah, I think that they're looking at the different colors of ink, as you're describing, as a shorthand way to identify instances in which an elections official might have completed some of the information. You know, it is possible that they are being a little bit over-inclusive by looking at the different ink colors. You know, just to be clear, as of now, those are the ballots that they're flagging, but those arguments have been rejected. And right. As the recount proceeds, those votes still are being counted.
Thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Rob Yablon from the UW Law School, looking at Wisconsin's recount and other election issues related to the law. Molly joins us next in Madison. Molly, hi.
Hi. I have been working the recount in Dane County, and it's been very interesting and informative. But I think two things I'm wondering if Professor Yablon can get to is, a lot of the focus is on the absentee ballots, and there's a lot of information required on that. But as I understand it, voter fraud really requires some indication that the voter has intentionally done something illegal. And as I understand it, case law looks at what the voter's intention was when they filed their ballot, and that a lot of what's on the envelopes and signatures of clerks on ballots is all election process stuff that doesn't really relate to what the voter may have intended or not intended.
Molly, thanks for the call. Process versus the accusation of fraud, Rob.
Yeah, I mean, I think that she's drawing some of the right lines there. You know, there have been very few indications of any fraudulent activity. I don't think that there are many objections being made during the recount process that are fraud related. In other words, that the voter was maybe unknowingly ineligible or something like that. Instead, they are objecting to these technical defects. And the caller is right that when you're looking at the ballot itself, what you're actually thinking about is what was the voter's intent. And so, you know, when we look at ballots, sometimes there might be some technical problem with the ballot. Like maybe you had someone that filled in a bubble for one of the two presidential candidates and then also wrote in their name. And so the machine might not have counted that ballot, but you can look at that ballot and the voter's intent will be quite clear. And so, you know, my understanding is that as they're going through and doing the recount, those kinds of votes are, in fact, counted.
Thanks for the call. Time for another caller. Kurt is on the line in Watertown. Kurt, hi.
Hi. Well, it's odd that I'm on the phone. I guess I really want to say that I feel optimistic based on what's happening now. I think it shows that the system is working, and it doesn't matter what kind of chaos is happening at the top. I really do believe if you hire crazy, you get crazy. So we can, you know, that's a lesson that we'll learn down the road too. What can possibly go wrong when people say, well, what's it matter who I vote for? Now they can see what happens if you pick somebody that's creating an entertainment show at the top.
Kurt, thanks for the call. Just a minute or so left, Rob, but Kurt's initial point, he's optimistic the system is being tested by the current president and his campaign, and Kurt says it looks like it worked pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, I think if there's a silver lining here, it is that the system has been scrutinized maybe like never before, and people are getting educated about some of the minutiae of the electoral process, and they're seeing that actually it does work, and that there really are safeguards in place that despite, you know, just sort of allegations of fraud, when you dig in a little bit deeper, you don't see it. And so for many people, I hope that this does end up being a confidence building exercise, although my fear is that there will be some who continue to stoke those tensions, still make allegations of fraud. And so the challenge now is to try to convince some of those folks that really this is a legitimate result. Sometimes in a democracy you win, sometimes you lose, but you come back and you try again next time.
Good place to leave it. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Good to be with you.
Robert Yablon is an associate professor in the UW Law School and an expert on election law. He talked with us today about Wisconsin's ongoing partial recount and a lawsuit that's seeking to throw out the state's election results. Coming up, Ufta will get a taste of a brand new music album from a couple of proud Wisconsinites that blends humor, bluegrass, and their love for the Badger State. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. With Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald heading to Congress, state Senate Republicans have chosen new leadership for the upcoming session. Coming up, we'll talk with the incoming Senate president about the GOP's approach to COVID-19, redistricting the state budget, and more. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with more on an album being released this week.
Two proud Wisconsinites have joined forces to create an album celebrating all things Wisco. Comedian Charlie Behrens of Manitowoc Minute fame and musician Adam Gruhl with the Bluegrass Darlings, Horseshoes and Hand Grenades have released Unthawed. The album blends both of their strengths, Behrens' classic comedy and Gruhl's musical chops.
So roll out the barrel and strike up a band. Evans Praise Lombardi, the pack is back again.
It's country sort of flavored with like a little blues.
I always wondered if Bango is offended when I wore blaze orange to a Bucks game. I'm like, sorry, guy, it's my Sunday's best. What can I do?
I don't know if Adam will agree with this, but I like to think of it as like a good old Midwest junk drawer. You got a tennis ball in there. You got a Packers bumper sticker in there. You got a muddle in there for your old fashions.
So it's a little bit of everything. Behrens says the album may sound random to non-Midwesterners, but overall, Unthawed is a love letter to Wisconsin and its people. Behrens and Gruhl laugh about the Wisco-isms they grew up with, from the wintertime blues to Packers coaches to Craigslist misconnections.
Adam came on tour with me for a few shows. He started with songs, and then I would come on and we'd do all Wisconsin Jubilee, the one song we could do together. You know, we start writing other songs in the green room, naming your towns. We started writing in Green Lake. I had just heard from one person, like, you know, there aren't even any rapids in Wisconsin Rapids. And so that, I was like, well, that would be a funny line. Well, there ain't no rapids in Wisconsin Rapids, Green Lake Shore, the blue.
Now Jesus had himself 12 apostles, so how come there's 22 apostle islands?
Yeah, you know, and just having fun getting goofy with some of the ironies and, like, you know, some of the cultural components. Charlie and I, thankfully, we have fun when we write. So, like, I'm thinking back to writing Supper Club Shuffle, which was just at the place I live here in central Wisconsin. We were just chilling upstairs, looking out over the Wisconsin River and kind of laughing about, you know, some of the things you bump into at supper clubs, like taxidermy and things like the old fashioned and the guy who brags about the buck on the wall and things like that. So our fondness for some of the Wisconsin culture definitely comes out in this record.
So come on down, don't forget to muddle. We'll all do the supper club shuffle. Come on down, make mine a double. We'll all do the supper club shuffle.
When you talk about the Midwest, it's often viewed as a flyover place. And I think we started to think about, well, why is that? And I think the reason is not enough people have pulled out the trees from the forest, you know, and had those things that we can latch onto and say, oh, that's something cool that's unique to here, that why not identify with it? The South has all those things, you know, there's sweet tea and pecan pie and a bunch of other crap that Zac Brown puts in his songs. Not crap, you know, but, you know, or crap, whatever. But why can't the Midwest embrace its culture in the same way as the South has?
I love that you said that, because sometimes when you hear songs like this, like, some people will clump it into this Midwestern, Wisconsin, UP, like, shticky type of music. But I like that you want to reclaim it and make it serious, like someone like Zac Brown has.
Yeah, because it's the same vibe, you know. I mean, we're all people, and I do have a love for all those shticky kind of deals and the polka and all that. I think there's room for both, I guess.
While Unthawed has a number of lighthearted and funny songs, it kicks off on a serious note with Ope Nope. Adam Gruhl was on a solo backpacking trip out west, and Charlie Behrens encouraged him to write when he was out there. Gruhl was hiking when Ope Nope came to mind.
I'm sort of starting to be homesick and missing things back in Wisconsin. And, you know, one difficult thing about this pandemic, of course, has been just not having the fellowship, not having that sense of community, at least physically, that we've had, you know, for so long and grown accustomed to.
Friends I know, it's a troubled earth, but we've got each other for what it's worth.
But then Charlie and I met up in Stevens Point and started working on it, and that's where the rest of the song got written. Right, Chuck?
Yeah. As we've been in this whole COVID time the past few years, there's been so much division in Wisconsin especially, and you see it amplified from our politicians and some media. And listen, we have people intentionally splitting us up to tear us down. You know, I mean, that is the playbook. It's been the playbook historically for how you get people on your side and win things like maybe elections, but it's not the playbook for a happy society.
Oh, no, let's build a spire down by the river, go swinging on a tire with a couple of good friends riding high.
Sure, life's difficult right now. There's a lot to divide us, but hey, we can still come together over some things that we all celebrate, like being outside, hanging out by a fire. And, you know, I think that's what we need more than ever right now, is to look for the commonalities in us all and focus on those. I'm trying to do that with some of my family members, for instance, that I know I don't agree with entirely, and still say, well, how's the fishing been? One of my favorite parts about music is its ability to bring people together and to pick you up when you're feeling blue. When I was making this album, it made me smile to think that somebody's going to listen to this and they're not going to be having a good day. And they're going to hear one of these tunes and their day is going to be turned around and
their next conversation with somebody is going to be lighter. And, you know, life will be a little bit easier and they'll be able to go take a walk and smile at life. That's one of the coolest things about music. And it's in this record. I know it is.
That was Adam Gruhl and Charlie Behrens, whose new album Unthawed came out this week. To hear our full interview and more songs from the album, go to the Wisconsin Life podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll talk with the new state Senate president about the Republicans' priorities for the upcoming legislative session, including what to do about COVID-19. That's up next here on Central Time.
Lombardi is Avenue.
Yeah, you know, I think LaFleur should have, she have a garden. Yeah.
Planted by me and you.
How about just you? I could kill rhubarb.
Yeah,
you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today on 1A Plus, scientists have dreamed about the possibilities of custom-made messenger RNA. The pandemic is turning those possibilities into reality. mRNA technology is a driving force behind some of these latest vaccines. How do they work? A look at the science. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, Republicans in the state Senate have elected new leadership after Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald won his race for Congress. Devin Lemahue will be the new majority leader when the next legislative session begins in January, and Chris Kapinga will serve as Senate president. Republicans added two seats in the November election, nearly flipping a third, which would have given them a veto-proof majority in that chamber. They'll return with a 20-12 advantage over Democrats, probably 21, assuming they hang on to the seat currently held by Fitzgerald. Challenges awaiting them include COVID-19, redistricting, the state budget, and more. Incoming Senate President Chris Kapinga talked to me earlier today. He's a Republican state senator from Wisconsin's 33rd district. That includes Delafield, Pewaukee, and Oconomowoc. Senator Kapinga, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start, first of all, with a new look in the state Senate. Your party picked up two seats there and a change of leadership. What are your thoughts on the outcome of the election in your chamber?
Well, we've had Senator Fitzgerald has been in the chamber leadership for, I think it's 14 years now. So with him moving on and Senator Lemahue being the majority leader-elect, and then myself moving into the president spot, obviously our focus as new leadership is going to be just making sure we have excellence. We're listening to the caucuses. We're listening to the minority party. And probably more importantly at this point, we're going to try to focus on having good communication with the governor's office and the speaker.
One of the big issues to communicate on is, of course, COVID-19. On Monday, we talked to the president of the Wisconsin Hospital Association. He wrote a letter to Governor Evers and a lot of the leadership in the Assembly and Senate to work together. He says healthcare workers, especially under a lot of stress, getting overwhelmed here. What kind of priorities do you see now or in the next session when it comes to COVID-19 health and economic relief?
One of the really good things that they have in there is a recommendation that I think all the sides can get around is there's a concern right now with a workload on healthcare workers, and anybody who has is in it or has a family member in it knows that it's taking its toll. I'm getting emails almost every day from people in the field. But what we do is we've actually got some flexibility in place to allow hospitals to make decisions on who best fits into the spots. And we give them flexibility with licensing so that they say, hey, if a lower level license can actually fill this spot and do it adequately, we allow for that to be done so that they don't have such a strain on the workforce. So that's something that we're looking at continuing. There's also liability reform that the Senate has come out with probably a few weeks ago just to protect schools. We've heard a lot from school administrators just on, hey, we're really concerned about with kids in person, even if it's just a hybrid version, we don't want to have a lawsuit come at us because we're actually teaching the kids and one of them would happen to get COVID. So that's another really important measure that that we're hearing a lot from. So those are a couple of things that I think there's common ground, and we'll focus on other things like that we can get across the finish line.
One thing I've heard from some public health experts is it isn't in all cases so much, you know, a mandate or legislation, but, you know, having leaders speak in more or less one voice to the public to take this thing seriously. What kind of things would you say to your constituents about COVID-19? So we've got big numbers in the state and you're part of the state right now.
It's really important that everyone understands, and this is something that I've been saying publicly too, and other members have been talking about this in our caucus, just about, you know, the CDC does have guidelines in place, and we know that the social distancing and cleanliness, that does make a difference. So everybody stay focused on those things. Fortunately, we're watching the numbers on a daily basis right now, and we are seeing a little bit of a turn down. So we're really hopeful that that trend continues so that we can kind of get away from the high levels that we're at right now. So there is some hope as we watch that kind of peak and start coming down that we can continue the trend with the numbers to make sure the hospital systems do not get to a point where they are overrun.
Talking to State Senator Chris Kapinga about COVID-19 right now, but also looking ahead at priorities for the next legislative session and the next year. And let's start looking toward the future. A lot on the agenda for 2021, including it's a state budget year, which is kind of the biggest thing you all do in the legislature and the governor's office for that matter. What kind of priorities? I know it's still early days. What kind of priorities are you looking at for the new budget?
I think the first thing we're going to do when we get into office is pass a resolution and ask unanimous consent that we're all thankful we're out of 2020. I think that'll be the first order of business we do. But with a budget coming, what we're watching really closely is the numbers that are coming in right now, just to see. Our hope is that we're seeing Q3 came in fairly decent. We didn't have a big dip. Q4, the preliminary numbers that we're seeing actually look fairly good too. So the big thing is, if we can continue strong numbers economically, we don't have to start having the conversations about utilizing the rainy day fund or worse, cuts. We do have a significant balance in the set aside rainy day fund right now, exactly for situations like this, where you have an unplanned pandemic going on. We can utilize those funds if we have to hopefully plug some gaps. I think the big thing everybody's hoping is that we don't have to start getting into conversations about cuts.
Are there things that in that budget that you say, you know, even if we do need cuts, this is where we really need to hold the line, these are priorities, or flip it around, things that you think are maybe low-hanging fruit for budget cuts?
Well, I think that it's interesting, the conversations that are going on right now just about education. And we don't know what adjustments or changes may be necessary, but just all the conversations that are going on, I think on both sides of the aisle, in both caucuses, with administrators and DPI, is just the way that we're educating kids has changed so drastically. And I think we have to get our arms around, is that going to be more of a long-term change? And if so, are there adjustments we have to make either up or down in certain areas? We know mental health is going to be a big issue. I just spoke with someone from a larger company in the area, and she said that they are dealing with unprecedented mental health issues in their workforce as they work remotely. So I know that's going to be something that comes back up, and we'll have to kind of look at the strategy on, hey, are there going to be significant costs related to that we need to plug in?
Another big issue for 2021. We just had a census in 2020, which means it's time to break out the maps and markers next year and draw new legislative boundaries. Governor Evers has floated the idea of a nonpartisan commission taking on that role. I know Republicans in the legislature not super into that idea. What are you looking at when it comes to redistricting next year?
Well, we actually looked at the nonpartisan commission when we spent time in this a couple of years ago, and I was fortunately on the committee for that. And we just came to the conclusion that it's really hard. And we spoke with other states, both Republican and Democrat states, who have gone through this before. And they all kind of came to the same conclusion that it's really hard to actually have a nonpartisan commission. So with that being said, we wanted to make sure that we maintained that the legislature, which is the voice of the people, maintains control of those maps. And then obviously we have to make sure we're following what the Constitution has in place. So the legislature will go through the process like we always have. will draw the maps, and then the governor will have to make a decision on whether he passes that or vetoes it. If he vetoes it, then it will go to the courts, and the courts will have to take a look at it.
Everybody I've talked to says that what you just said means the courts are going to have to decide on this. I mean, can you see a process where you sit down with Democrats, with the governor, and work together on a map that you all can agree on without having to make it a legal process?
It would be nice to live in the world of, yes, we're going to sit down and have a great conversation and strike a deal on it. But the reality is, just with the current election that we just got through and some of the historical things over the last few months with the governor's office, I think it's going to be difficult to come to a consensus. Obviously, I think that's everybody's goal. But that being said, my expectation is that this will likely end up in the courts. So we're the legislature is working on if we would have to obtain legal counsel. We're looking into that side of it right now, and I'm sure the governor's office is doing the same thing.
Finally, I want to look at this year's election. We had the president tweet at one point he wants state legislatures to look at stepping in and appointing slates of electors instead of going with the popular vote. And there's a lawsuit right now in Wisconsin asking the state Supreme Court to put it in the legislature's hands. Do you want that? Do you want the role of selecting electors to come down to you all in the legislature?
Based on my discussions with the caucus so far, I just don't think that there's any appetite to start discussing major changes to how we do it. We're comfortable that the voice of the people needs to be the decision point for who our electors actually vote for. So we want to maintain that process. The discussion really is around the integrity of the vote, and we want to make sure that the election officials are following the process of law that's in place. And that's really what the court cases are about right now. It's just, hey, did they follow the law? And we're already discussing as well, are there election reform issues? And there's going to most likely be a joint hearing. I don't think we're going to get it in this year, but early next year, where the election committees pull in people from the who actually worked in the elections and determine, do we need to make some adjustments to our system to ensure that every legal vote is counted and no illegal votes are counted?
Senator Kapinga, thanks a lot for joining us. Enjoy the holiday.
Thanks, you too.
Chris Kapinga is a Republican state senator from Wisconsin's 33rd district. That includes Delafield, Pewaukee, and Oconomowoc. He's the incoming Senate president. We talked to him about Republican priorities for the upcoming session, including COVID-19, redistricting, and the state budget. Working here at Public Radio, none of us expect to become famous ever in any way, but our own Bill Martins, Central Time producer, hit the big time this week when a video he took of snow in Middleton got picked up by TV stations all over the place. Hey, Bill.
Hey, color me surprised. That was really weird yesterday.
It was. So you just give us the story here. What happened?
So I'm sitting at my computer yesterday morning, and I looked out the window, and it was snowing kind of hard. And I thought, oh, that's cool, and my phone is right there. I'm just going to take a little video of this. So I did that, and then I thought, you know what, I'm going to tweet this, and I'm going to tag a couple of weather people on it, and a couple of hashtags as well, and we'll see where this goes. And within just a few minutes, I start getting requests from some national weather outlets asking if they can use the footage. So I was asked by the Weather Channel and Weather Nation and AccuWeather and this other company called Storyful, which I think just scans social media and then makes that available to other news outlets to use if the user allows it. So I said, sure, go ahead. And then my mother-in-law in the Twin Cities texted me before bed last night and says, hey, Bill, I saw your video on Fox 9 last night. I'm like, get out of here. And then there was a weather guy in Cleveland at a TV station who retweeted it. I don't know why people in Cleveland would care about garden variety snowfall in Middleton, but whatever floats their boat, I guess. I'm happy about it.
Now, you're a good photographer. We know this. And apparently you're a good videographer as well. You've worked in TV before, though on the other side of the camera, I think. I don't know. Are you gonna be too big for Central Time pretty soon?
I might. You know, Central Time also retweeted that video, which got my head pretty huge. So my days with you guys might be numbered. I think I'm on to bigger and better things.
Well, don't forget the little people, Bill.
I won't.
That's Central Time producer Bill Martins talking about his brush with greatness. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, start Thanksgiving off with some advice and inspiration for holiday cooking. Maybe you get something you can use for your own Thanksgiving meal. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news for NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it's our weekly look at some of the top national political stories, including President-elect Joe Biden finally getting a formal go-ahead from the Trump administration to begin the transfer of power. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.